I think they really want to help the communities. They want to help their families out, and they come with a great, great heart. But I think what happens is they get disheartened. They get frustrated and they give up.
Hi, this is Alexandria from Sacramento, California. You're listening to Your Financial Planner, Now What? The podcast that helps you fast track your career by bringing you meaningful conversations on topics that influence new financial planners, their careers, and the lives of their clients.
This is episode 206, and our host, Alexandria Davis, has a compelling interview with Luis Barajas, a CFP with over 30 years' experience in the profession. His origin story is an inspiration and a challenge for financial planners everywhere to educate yourself, look for creative solutions to problems, and to give back to your community. Up next, Luis shares fantastic stories and wisdom from his history in financial planning, as well as how a chance meeting changed his life forever. But before that, this episode is powered by Janice Henderson Investors. For the sixth year in a row, exchange-traded funds are all the rage among financial advisors, with 85% of financial advisors surveyed currently using or recommending ETFs with their clients. The most popular investment vehicle among 22 options, according to the latest annual survey by the Financial Planning Association, the Journal of Financial Planning, and Janice Henderson Investors. To learn more about other trends in investing and access all the findings in the survey, please visit financialplanningassociation.org.
So hi, Luis. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. I know our listeners are in for a treat to hear your story and just perspective on giving back. I know I'm anxious, and so I don't want to take any more time up. Let's just have you share a little bit about your background and kind of where you started, Luis. Let the listeners know where that what that looks like.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on here on the podcast. I'm a big fan. My background is, you know, I was born and raised in Boyle Heights, California, and back in the 60s and 70s, a pretty rough neighborhood. My parents are Mexican immigrants. My dad started his own business when I was 11 years old. And so being the eldest of two children, and because I spoke English, I had to help my dad with all the paperwork, not because I wanted to, but because I had to. And at age 11, I, you know, got the business license from my father. At age 13, the IRS came to my dad's workshop, and my dad hadn't filed tax returns. And they asked him that he needed to file tax returns within a couple months. And he looked at me and said, "Do you know how to file tax returns?" And I looked at him and I said, "I don't even know what those are." So the way I made it out of the body was that I read books. Used to love to read books. I had an uncle who used to give me books all the time. So we found a bookstore that had a book on how to file tax returns. I filed his returns. And at age 15, we got audited for those tax returns. And my dad and I went to the audit, and we were nervous as heck, and we didn't know what we were doing. And I went up there, and I think the auditor, IRS auditor, felt sorry for us and basically had a no-change audit. But I made a commitment on that particular day that I would learn everything about personal finance and money so I can help my dad. And so, again, where I grew up, there were no financial planners. Back then, 60% of Latinos were unbanked in the United States. 60% of Latinos in the United States were unbanked. And so that's what happened. That's when I made the commitment. And then I ended up going to UCLA, getting an MBA at Claremont Graduate School, where I started with Peter Drucker. Ended up going into financial planning. I hated it because back then it was really just commission-based, and I didn't want to sell product. I wanted to do planning. So I ended up going to a firm called Kenneth Leventhal in Newport Beach, California. Well, I had just was finishing up my certified financial planning designation and started working with some really wealthy people at a big CPA firm doing financial planning and helping some billionaires do financial planning. And so I realized that that's what I wanted to do. That's exactly what I wanted to do. I said, one day I'm going to go back and help my community and really focus on, which there was no word called fee-only financial planning. At least I don't remember that, and do what I was doing, and I could provide those services. I'll take you now to 19. So this is back in, I graduated, started the financial planning industry around 1985. In 1990, at the firm at Kenneth Leventhal in Newport Beach, I had several tragedies. My grandmother passed away unexpectedly. My uncle committed suicide, and my first daughter was born. And on the day that my daughter was born, I met a gentleman at a coffee shop on that particular day in the morning that changed my life. It was just a random meeting with him. And I was overwhelmed because of, again, the death of my grandmother, the suicide of my uncle, and the birth of my daughter. And we had this long conversation at a coffee shop, and he changed my life. I went back to the hospital. My parents showed up 3 hours later, and I made a commitment. I said, "Dad, I'm going to be quitting Canada's 11th on Monday. I'm going to go back to the vibrant health community. I think that I have a lot to, I can help. I think there's a lot, I have a lot to offer. You know, I will tell you that because we don't have a lot of time on the podcast, that the gentleman that I met on September 8th, 1990 at 7 o'clock in the morning in Lake Forest, California, wrote a book 10 years later when I wrote my very first book 10 years later that got published by HarperCollins. And the book that he, and we met at that time again, and the book that he wrote, the title of his book was the topic that he spoke to me 10 years earlier at the coffee shop. And it was a guy named Rick Warren who wrote a book called A Purpose-Driven Life. And so I, you know, he said things to me that literally just changed my life. And I quit, went back to the body, went back to Whittier and Indiana, which is like the main artery where Latinos live in LA, and started my firm there. And I ended up working there for probably 15 years in the barrio, giving back to our community. And I realized that the community needed more than financial literacy. They needed to change kind of their mindset. So that's what my books were about. So I've written five. I'm almost completed my sixth book now. You know, we've merged into, we've become a business management firm for Latin celebrities. We handle, our investment firm handles $250 million for clients. I do a lot of pro bono work throughout the country. I speak at a lot of events nationally on overcoming issues of poverty.
Wow. I don't even know where to start. That's an amazing, what's crazy is it's an amazing story, right? The thing that just blows my mind is the interesting encounter people start with when it comes to money or taxes in your situation and how young people are basically exposed to it. You know, really it took you not knowing anything about tax returns and the fact that you filed probably a personal and a business tax return.
It was a business tax. It was a Schedule C, yeah, a sole proprietorship.
Oh my gosh, like that's amazing. And just conceptually to just know that you can take it on and start doing it. And you guys, I mean, team, it always really starts back at home with their family orientation of where you see money and what your exposure is going to be. So I just think that that's amazing commitment and that you knew at such a young age that when you got exposed to that, that that was going to be the thing that you were going to do, you know, obviously for your life, way more now, right? Encompassing, but it took that one little exposure of the tax return to be like, this is what Lewis is going to be about.
Well, life is interesting, right? Because again, you know, I noticed that among at least minorities, you know, whether you're African-American or you're like, you know, I realized, for example, I have friends who their first encounter when they had their parents had an issue, a medical issue, and they were the translator for their parents at the hospital. And if they were sick, if their parents were sick for a long time, it was this kid who had to translate for their parents. And I have friends who went through the same thing and they've become doctors. I've had clients who, friends who are the eldest and they had to be the translators because their parents were being sued when their parents didn't understand English and they had to be the translator. And then the funny part is, it's just, you know, the synchronistic events of what happened. And these are my friends who told me the same story, but they became lawyers. It just happened to be that my dad needed, you know, financial help. And again, being the eldest, and out of necessity, I guess we take on a certain level of responsibility and then we see the need for it. And that's why we jump in and help out.
I want to kind of fast forward a little bit. You touched on this about when you really joined the financial planning profession. And you kind of talked about commission-based and fee-based. And really your first encounter with Rick Warren, it sounds like it's all kind of happening at the same time. Can you touch just a little bit more about kind of how you got into, like if it was Rick that introduced you into the profession or when you were at college, like what was like that first couple steps or your first job, or did you go right into your business of helping people? How was that?
It was, again, just a series of just, you know, synchronistic events. I meet Rick Warren. That was already kind of late. That was already back in 1990. I started. So I graduated from UCLA like back in 1984, but it wasn't, you know, I didn't know that I was going into financial planning, to be quite honest with you. What I did is I wanted to learn everything about money and business. And so I ended up going to UCLA. And I didn't even know that there was a program called an MBA. You can get an MBA like in finance or marketing or whatever. I remember my roommate at UCLA said, I'm going to go get an MBA. And I said, what's that? A master's in business. He goes, oh my God, really? There's a master's in business? And ended up applying. And then while I was getting my master's in business, I met one of the students there that says, well, I'm going to be a financial planner. And what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to do stocks. And, this. And so back then, he ended up working the year before I graduated my MBA program back in 87, prior, 1 year before that. And he recruited me, and it was back then IDS American Express, and then it became obviously Ameriprise, right? And he recruited me into that, and I got my Series 7 and all the other licenses that I needed to get. And so what I did was I started learning about stocks and bonds and mutual funds back then and annuities. But I realized that I was taught financial planning, and the beginning is you should have a cash reserve, and you should have an estate plan, and you should do a plan. I was doing that. I was the number one planner in LA for Ameriprise doing plans, but I was around people that didn't have a lot of money, and I had to build a cash reserve. I wanted to build a foundation. And then I started having conversations with managers who were basically kind of telling me, you could put them in annuities and build their cash reserves through there. And that way you win and they win. But I never saw how it would benefit the client. I've always put the client first. And so after a couple of years of doing that, I just didn't feel I didn't feel very good about it. I just felt like I wouldn't want to do that to my parents. And so I left the profession, to be quite honest with you. That's why I went to go get Kenneth Leventhal at the accounting firm to go get a CPA license. But they found out that I could do that. I was already in the CFP program. And back then, accountants could not sell any product. And I started doing financial planning while I was getting my CPA license. And I fell in love with it. And I realized what real planning was. And I said, wow, this is probably for the super wealthy, but you could do this for anybody. Every family needs a financial plan. And because I come from poverty, I mean, my parents were very, very poor, very, very poor, but my parents needed a financial plan. So I realized that financial planning wasn't just for the wealthy, it was for everyone. And I wanted to make it accessible to everyone.
That's really where it should be at. I mean, that's where it should have been always, right? But now it's like, there's a lot more people putting the focus of families, and that, everybody needs a level of financial planning, because we have to start somewhere. And one of the things that you also talked about was your books, and how you're already on book 6. So you're a big writer. And what I love about even just the books without, necessarily going in depth and reading one right now, but it's just the titles, right? When you think of people think of financial planning, they maybe jump to investing, stocks, Wall Street, the market. But when I look at your book titles, overworked, overwhelmed, underpaid, those are just how Americans feel about relationships with money, or the, small business, big life for women. It's just like these titles are speaking to people that are dealing with everyday problems or situations. What drove you to wanting to start offering this knowledge through books? And how did you come up with this stuff? Because, I don't think a whole lot of this is maybe taught at school or in your CFP program. So maybe just kind of share how you are different in that space where you're providing knowledge to overall Americans.
Well, again, because my clientele base is very different. I mean, back then it was with pretty much every poor person that I worked with. I mean, they didn't have a lot of assets. And so what I realized back then was that there wasn't a lot of financial literacy. Remember, there was no internet. Nobody's going online and getting information. And so you had to make information available normally through books. But what I realized when I went back to the community was that no amount of financial literacy was going to help anybody that is poor. Because I grew up poor, but I grew up with loving, loving parents. So I had a wonderful childhood. I can tell you that I had one of the best childhoods ever. And we didn't have a lot. But I didn't know that I was poor. I really didn't. I ended up going to college, getting my MBA, ended up moving to Orange County, California, working in Newport Beach, hanging out with really super wealthy people, multimillionaires and billionaires. And then you don't realize that you change. The way you think changes, your attitude changes, your thoughts change, but you don't see it. And then when I made that commitment on September 8th, 1990, to head back to East LA, and started working with the community, I started teaching and doing financial planning, and I'm more of a teacher at heart. I realized that no amount of financial literacy was going to help my community out if I was going to help them. And I started realizing that there were certain cultural, at least because I deal with the Latino community, limiting cultural beliefs that were sabotaging even their mindset about believing that they could have any form of financial success. And back then, my mindset was not even financial success. What I was calling financial significance. That's what one of the titles of my book was called Financial Greatness. And so that's where I started saying, well, where is there a book where I can talk to them about the Patron Peon system or business on a handshake or all the limiting cultural beliefs? There wasn't anything. And so I just started speaking about it. And then I started writing little articles about it. And then somebody said, you should turn it into a book. And that's what happened. You know, there's one of the books is called My Street Money. I was on CNN when Barack Obama was running for president and they were doing the debates, and they brought me on CNN, Roland Martin did. And he had me on live after the debate. And he said, look, we brought Lewis here to talk about not Wall Street, but Main Street to the regular folks. And I said, Roland, and there's if you Google it, you can see that tape on YouTube. I said, Roland, I honestly, I don't know about Wall Street or Main Street, but I can tell you about my street. And tonight on my street, they didn't talk about Social Security. On my street, people aren't putting money in 401ks. They don't have money to put in 401ks. On my street, they don't buy stocks because they don't even know what the stock market is. And that's where My Street Money came from, because there's a group of people out there, millions of people that nobody's attending to, nobody's paying attention to, because it's not profitable for them. But again, if you're a business person and know how to create and implement systems, you can attend to those clients and you can do it rather profitably. But the thing is that how do you reach these people and how do you approach them in a way that they can actually listen to what you're saying and they can understand what you're saying? Because we forget that we learn all this terminology, and when we're talking to the people, they're intimidated by that, all the information we're giving them. They're intimidated by the way we speak and how we say things as compared to talking to them in their own language.
Yeah, that's a big one. It's like meeting people where they are.
That's it.
We started out in their shoes at one point, not knowing this terminology. I mean, especially for the next gen community, we're still building that knowledge. And so even you have some fears that maybe you don't know enough, you know, but really it's taking a step back and really meeting people where they are. So that way, when you are communicating about these topics, people, they really do begin to trust you. They go, hey, Lewis is not only is he knows his stuff, but he's real. He knows what we're talking about, what we're going through, and I feel comfortable having him help me. That's like a whole nother level that, you know, comes up in, especially with working with different communities, is the trust level when it comes to money and when they have what little or all money that they have and having to be able to give trust to someone else within their community to help them with that. I mean, there's so many layers that have to be peeled back when working with different people with different backgrounds before you can just go, hey, I can manage money and I can help you build a plan. You know, there's so many other layers prior to that.
Absolutely.
This kind of is a nice like segue, because you did touch on this several times, but I think it's always very interesting when people mention, I want to be able, or especially financial planners, I want to be able to help my community, right? It means so many different things to each individual person. And I just wanted to see, for you, I know you said you finally moved back, you know, and then was living in East LA. And that was the time when you started to make it more important to give back to your community, because you had to be back where they were. So what did you find that was so important that you felt like, I need to go back to where I came from in order to provide that knowledge and be able to give people what I have now?
Well, again, what I did was, I personally put myself in the position that I said, how is it that my father, who wanted to succeed and live a better life, have as a financial planner, as his consultant, an 11-year-old kid, right? Because he only spoke English, because he didn't have access to anybody else. And I thought, there is nobody in the community going back and helping them out. And the only people that I knew in the community is helping them out. I mean, a financial planner back then in a barrio was the real estate agent, right? Because it was something tangible. That was their financial planner, giving them horrific tax advice, no estate planning advice, nothing. And so I'm thinking, God, you know, where would my parents be if they would have had a Luis Barajas, who is a certified financial planner, enrolled agent, with years of experience in the community? And would they have paid a Luis Barajas if he would have been there to help them? And absolutely they would have. The problem is there was nobody that they had, and the people that they had in their community were sometimes the problem is that people in their own communities are the ones that are ripping them off. So yeah. I said, what needs to happen for me to be able to go back and see if I can bring in also young kids to help people in their own community or help their own, you know. And that's been the biggest struggle, right? For me, growth has been a struggle because to hire minorities, and especially I try to hire people that are also certified financial planners. It's very hard, right? I don't know if you know that I think only 3.5% of all certified financial planners in the industry are African American and Latino. So there's not a lot. And for me, as I continue to grow, it's not finding the needle in the haystack, it's finding the haystack. But that was the impetus to me going back and saying, how can I provide what my parents have paid? And the problem is because the prior way to get paid was by selling a product. And I wanted to prove that, no, there are plenty of people who are willing to pay you for advice if you are honest and if the conversation you're having with them is not manipulative. Because I also know a lot of people who are in the communities who are selling products. Like originally when I was out there selling products and my managers were telling me, look, you know, you can do what's good for them and good for you, and you can put them in an annuity, and which was not at that point for that particular client the best thing for them. And so I just think at the end of the day, somebody, you know, if you're going to be in and helping people, you have to have a conscience, and you have to know that you're really truly helping them out and not doing it because you want to do a game. The money comes. The money will come. You will be successful because people will talk to everyone about you when they realize that you're a good-hearted person doing the best thing for them and you're not focused on how much money can I make.
One of the challenges that you touched on was about the growth and finding, you know, minorities to work, you know, with your company and in your community. I know that is a big thing that our profession faces, is just having people with different backgrounds being able to support communities, minority communities, or just communities out there in general.
Yes.
What would you say, and how have you been promoting that within your firm or within the profession to help basically change that the problem that we have right now with that?
Well, right now, which just so you know, I at one point with the Financial Planning Association, I was on the national board of the FPA. Yes. And I'll share a quick story. I mean, you know, all the FPA members, you know, when you come in as a national board member, you cannot bring your own agenda to the group because you're basically talking about the overall Financial Planning Association, right? And mm-hmm. It's not about fee-based or commission or fee-only, whatever. It's about what's best for the association. But I did not do that. I did bring my own agenda because back then, it was like 2004 to 2006, I realized that every time that I went to a national conference, I could maybe pick out 2-3 black people and 1-2 Latinos. That's it. Mm-hmm. Out of 3,000 people. And I looked around and I said, you know, this has got to change. And so when I was on the national board, I kept pushing and I kept pushing diversity. And, you know, we really never got around to it. But I kept, you know, every conversation I would bring diversity and we would need, and I said, you need to watch the demographic of America and how it's changing. If not, we're going to, the association is going to lose because it was most of the people in the association were older white men. And they're going to be retiring, dying off, and whatever. And the demographics in the United States is the minority groups are growing, and we need to bring these people in. And I will share with you that I got all my mentoring by white Anglo men who were the nicest people, who took me by the hand, who helped me, and were the most incredible. If it were not for the FPA, I tell you right now, I would not be where I'm at right now. And it was the national conferences that changed my life. Not the local ones, but the national conferences. And to me, now I'm in a, it was called the DAG, or Diversity Advisory Group, for the Center for Financial Planning, the CFP Board Center for Financial Planning. And we're constantly working on creating ideas of how we can recruit people of color to come to, or people to come in and work in communities that are underserved, right? There's a tremendous amount of need. The problem is that there's not enough people to mentor young kids coming in, and those, and they've got to kind of figure it out themselves. And the problem is, if we don't make them sustainable in their communities, they're not going to hang around. And so at some point, you know, it's unfortunate that they, you know, they need to go work for someone else to learn the ropes and eventually go off on their own and go into their communities. But we have to figure out a way that they can become sustainable so they can stay there in those communities. Because I will share with you, it was not easy for me. It took years before I became profitable. I sacrificed probably about 5 or 6 years before I really started making any kind of money to support a family.
Yeah, that is a big point of really just how do we make them sustainable, you know, so that way, give them the experience portion, right?
Right.
Mentorship, helping them to pass the CFP exam. I mean, there's so many, I don't want to call them barriers, but things that you have to do to even get to the level before you can, hey, let's start helping people, you know? And so
Right. What
you shared is very important. I want to kind of transition us a little bit more regarding the advice to next gen. So what advice would you say you have for just the next gen or the young professionals that are coming up that are wanting to give back in a different way through the companies that they're working at currently, that is going to kind of shift things of how their current structure of their firms are at? Because a lot of them do give back, you know, maybe they do a food bank drive, or they do some pro bono work, you know, once, you know, a quarter, but maybe they have a lot more drive to get really involved in their communities, or even providing services to the communities that they want. What advice do you have for them?
Here's my take. This is going to be very interesting, and because I've done it for so long and I've worked in communities of really impoverished means, but I don't believe in what most people think of as pro bono. I just don't. I believe in pro bono when there are catastrophes, pandemics, hurricanes. I believe in pro bono when it comes to that. When it comes to working with underserved, I have figured out that if a person does not pay for advice, they will take it as an opinion, and they will rarely implement it, or rarely follow up and follow through with it. And so when I was in the Bible, I was charging, let's say if I was going to charge $300 for a financial plan back then, and if I knew somebody could not afford it, and they could afford, you know, $50 or $25, or maybe if they couldn't afford it, I would still charge them $20, because those $20 hurt. They knew they needed me, and they would pay me the $20. And I could have taken that money and given it away if I wanted to. I needed it, but you know, the thing, it wasn't about the $20. It was about the mindset of that individual paying for that advice. Now, pro bono work that I do, for example, today, I did a 2-hour training session for an organization on a Zoom, with 75 people called New Economics for Women in Los Angeles. They cater to single mothers and build low-income housing, but create these incredible programs of prosperity. And so my goal is that I can't have 75 Luis Barajas's out there. It's just impossible to find. But I had 75 staff members that work with over 1,000 residents and help them solve issues of poverty. And I said, well, why not help them consistently to create programs for them to teach their staff, so the staff can then help the residents. And so those are the areas that I look at in which I can create the biggest impact. you know, the food drives and all that are great, and I do those as well. But the problem is that's not where my happiness. When I give money or when I help in food banks, I feel happy, but I don't feel kind of a sense of purpose. When I give back to that nonprofit organization that's dealing in issues of poverty and helping to those people prosper, that's what I feel I was meant to do. And that's why I give the biggest impact. And I guarantee you that every single community has organizations like this that if you're really talented and you really want to help out, they're dying for people to come in and help them out. There's so much need out there. So that's my take on kind of the whole pro bono and giving back.
I really like how you broke that down, because I think it gets used interchangeably of like the word pro bono, the action of going to help someone versus, you know, they actually needing financial planning, right? And so it can get very confusing or watered down, or just maybe overused, right? The word pro bono in general can get overused.
Right.
To that point of the example you gave about mindset, no matter what the amount was, like you said, $50, $300, you know, the person who's paying $1,500, they feel it and know the value of who and what you're providing for them. And that's right. What's important.
Yeah, you're professional, right? You're seen as a professional. Anybody who's willing to pay something is a professional. If, you know, anybody can give you free advice. And again, whether you take it or not just depends on how much influence you have on that person. But as soon as somebody's willing to pay you something, then they're seeing you at a different level and they're going to respect you and they, you know, they're going to trust you. And knowing that you're, you know, and that's why I feel there are a lot of firms out there that don't allow a lot of young people to help people like that, to help other people in need. Why can't you take on, if you got 50 clients, why can't you have 10 clients who are going to pay you a little bit, whatever? What's wrong with that? And you never know. You know, let me just share with you again, because I've got 30 years into this, more than 30 years. I have blue collar workers, people in their 70s now, right? In their 70s that I started with that were in their 40s and who never made more than $40,000, $50,000 a year ever, and have invested with me in their retirement IRA rollovers over $1 million. People from Boyle Heights. And so I know that this works, and it just takes time. And what happens is that any young person coming into the profession needs to understand that yes, you're going to find trees that they have already fruit that is already ripe that you can, you know, start making money. But at the same time, you also start to have, you need to start planting seeds. These seeds will grow. As long as you water them, as long as you help them, as long as you're there, there's nothing better to tell you that I've got clients that I've had for 34 years and they stuck with me and I've been there with them through their divorces, through their illnesses, through whatever. And even now through some of them, they've got a lot of money and they're retired and they're not worried and they're not afraid. There's nothing more beautiful than that. And so I just think that a lot of people say, you've got to take on these clients. And those are the seeds that will also provide the shade for you as an advisor when you're, 55, 65, 70. Because when people ask me, when are you going to retire? I said, why would I retire? I love what I do. I love what I do. I'm never going to retire. People retire because they're fatigued, if they're working, they hate what they're doing. I have no plans. There's no financial planner that I would hire to plan for retirement. I would hire them to plan my estate plan and making sure that my money lasts. But, I love the profession. The FPA has been wonderful for me. And I think just getting involved and thinking long-term is how young people can really get engaged in the profession and really get a lot of purpose and meaning out of it.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Lewis. There's so much there that I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm over here taking notes and just listening. For a minute, forgot I was even doing the interview because I'm just listening and taking in so much of the information that you're sharing, that it basically is like the next gen community, the young people that are out there, we don't have limits, And so it's kind of like go out there and provide help to those who are willing to pay for the help. You know, obviously there's the CFP exam and other credentials you can get. But maybe you could talk a little bit to this briefly, because you've written so many books about topics that aren't maybe your mainstream topics that you would find at school or in a textbook. How did you begin to like really become more well-rounded about topics that are really the issues that people are dealing with? Because I could say that a lot of the information that I learned in college around some of the CFP topics are good, but they seem to be more swayed for if you have lots of money and can plan out all these different things, but it doesn't maybe address what most Americans are going through. So how did you really begin to educate yourself on that? Or what advice do you have for NextGen community about that?
You have to be a lifetime learner. You have to educate yourself. There are going to be a lot of books out there. There are going to be classes for if you're going to be helping, you know, the middle class or the lower middle class. You have to try to be a problem solver. So, you know, I studied issues on poverty. I read books. You know, there were no conferences. The conferences were outside the scope of the financial planning profession. Right. Right now, like for example, you have the Financial Therapy Association. Right. There wasn't that back then. You just have to be a student, and you have to be curious and wanting to help people and seek. Try to find information of how you can take information that you can process and then merge it with the financial planning information so it creates an impact on the individual and really changes their lives. But can I make a comment? I just want to make a comment because I know we get lots of people and I get so many phone calls from a lot of young financial planners, you know, Gen Xers who are trying to make a change, but they get so frustrated. I'm going to share with you 35 years what I've learned and what I know for sure. I think I only know one thing for sure is that I cannot help people who do not want to be helped. And when I was young, when I was in my late 20s, early 30s, when I saw people drowning, not literally drowning, but like drowning in debt or drowning, you know, when they needed help, you obviously, when you go in a community, it could be your own community, you can say, oh my God, I want to help them. They need so much help. But there was a confusion on my part. The confusion was that I always thought that people who need help want the help. And so there was a frustration in which I tried to help people and I didn't see that they wanted to be helped or they would not follow up and follow through with the advice. And I would see them year after year not getting any better. And then I realized they weren't ready for the advice. So if a lot of people who are listening to us who are just starting out and can actually see the need in their communities to help others and don't feel the love, don't get frustrated. You just move on to the next person because there are so many people that do need you and do want you. But the hardest thing for me to realize was that when somebody was drowning and I throw the lifesaver out of the boat, that they would push the lifesaver out, they would continue to drown, right? And that's a visual that I see. And there's nothing I can do at that point. So, because I need people to understand there's so much purpose and so much meaning in what I do, but I had to learn that sometimes I have to step away from clients who needed help more than anyone else, but they didn't want it or weren't ready for it. And so, you know, when you're in your 20s and 30s, sometimes we come with a very idealistic notion that we can help the world, but sometimes we just need to help the people in front of us who actually want the help.
Thank you so much, Lewis, for your time today. I mean, everything that you shared, there's so many good tidbits that people can really go and do something better for tomorrow. And especially with what's all going on today, community is important. And so I'm glad that you were able to share with us what you're involved in and how we can be better planners as we begin our journey on our 30 years of being in the profession. So I just want to say thank you so much for everything that you shared with us today.
No, well, thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity.
For the sixth year in a row, exchange-traded funds are all the rage among financial advisors, with 85% of financial advisors surveyed currently using or recommending ETFs with their clients. The most popular investment vehicle among 22 options, according to the latest annual survey by the Financial Planning Association, the Journal of Financial Planning, and Janus Henderson Investors. To learn more about other trends in investing and access all the findings in the survey, please visit financialplanningassociation.org.
Love what you hear on this podcast? Join us in the FPA Activate Facebook community, where you'll find a community of other passionate planners like you. Not only that, but there are live How We Do What We Do sessions focused on what real financial planning looks like in practice. Be sure to join us there to lend your voice, become a better planner, and help grow the financial planning profession.